Hello, world. Welcome to Discover Your Talent, Do What You Love, number 181. I'm creator and host, Don Hutchison. Every day, I interview someone from around the world who has discovered her talents to do work she loves to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. Today, I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Judge Ann Elizabeth Barnes. Welcome, Judge Barnes.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Question, are you using your talents doing work that you love?
Yes, I am. I wake up every day that I go to work. It's a joy to go. You know, the old saying about how you do work you love and you'll never work a day in your life. I love being a judge on the Georgia Court of Appeals. It's an intellectually satisfying experience.
Good. We want to hear the whole story. Thank you. Presiding Judge Ann Elizabeth Barnes won election in 1998 to the Georgia Court of Appeals in a three-way race without a runoff and took office January 1, 1999. She was the first woman to be elected in a statewide judicial race without having been first appointed on the bench and was reelected without opposition to a second term in 2004. In 2010, she was elected to a third term, receiving more votes than any other candidate in the state of Georgia. A native Georgian, Judge Barnes grew up in Chamblee and attended DeKalb County Public Schools. She received her bachelor's degree from Georgia State University and graduated magna cum laude in 1979. She earned a Juris Doctor from the University of Georgia in 1983 and her Master of Laws in the Judicial Process from the University of Virginia in 2004. All righty. That's a pithy summary of your career to date, Judge Barnes. Would you tell us what you're up to now that has you engaged and excited, if you will?
Well, the Georgia Court of Appeals is a fascinating court. It's one of the oldest intermediate state appellate courts in the nation, if not the oldest. It's over 100 years old. Many states only had state supreme courts, and there are some states, such as West Virginia, that don't even have an intermediate appellate court. Right now, our court is changing. For years, it has been the busiest, some say the most overworked intermediate state appellate court in the nation. Each judge on our court, and there are 12 of us now, authors over 150 opinions. And recently, our governor, Governor Nathan Deal, decided to give us some relief by appointing three additional judges, an additional panel, making our court, it will really be a different court because we'll have more judges and we will author fewer opinions per judge and we will have the influx of new talent. That's one of the great things on a court, that it's not like litigation or business in terms of competition. It's more of a cooperative, collective intellectual process. Although there are ups and downs and disagreements, it's a very satisfying process of coming to agreement and resolving not just the issues before us, but what the law is, as well as what the resolution of a single dispute is.
Let me ask you a question. That's very, not even being a student of this part of our world, just in a minute or so, can you tell us, this is the interim state appellate court. Can you tell us the levels of courts so that our listeners could frame this a little bit? Because they probably are as clueless as I am.
Well, our judicial system, in short, is bifurcated into state and federal. Everyone knows about the United States Supreme Court and their federal district courts throughout the country that are an intermediate appellate court, and also trial courts that are they're circuit courts and district courts, rather, circuits and districts. The district courts for federal are trial courts, district courts, and circuit courts are there. So that's the federal system. In short, the state systems are all different. As I believe it was Justice Brennan said, perhaps the states were intended to be sort of the laboratories for the federal system, and the state systems are all different, but virtually every state, the majority, has a state Supreme Court, a state Court of Appeals, and then various levels of trial courts. For instance, in Georgia, we have everything from traffic courts, probate courts, state and superior courts that have trials where people come with their disputes and bring witnesses, and a single judge makes a decision on who wins the dispute or whether someone is convicted or acquitted in a criminal matter. In the state of Georgia, we have our state Supreme Court, which consists of 7 justices, our state Court of Appeals, which is now 12 judges, Court of Appeals judges, with 3 panels, sitting in panels of 3.
Okay.
And we're soon to be 15 judges, which is still a very small number for a state intermediate court with a state of our size. For instance, Georgia has over 9 million people, and we only have 12 Court of Appeals judges. Louisiana probably has closer to 50 or 60 or more for a population of about 4 million.
That's fascinating. That is really fascinating. Do you breathe some sigh of relief that you're getting 3 more judges and another panel? Is that going to make your
report? Yes, certainly. Yes. Certainly. That will eventually, not immediately. Of course, immediately there's a learning curve for everyone. And just jumping into the breach is always difficult for a new judge. But it will bring the rest of us some immediate relief, yes.
Perfect. I love that. Well, as you well know, having lived on this planet a number of years, that human beings go through turning points in our lives, probably 7 or 8 of them that happen every 6 or 8 years, where we face choices and changes and obstacles and issues where then we back up and take a look at ourselves and move forward or make different plans. Take us back as far in your story as you will and tell us about the more memorable turning points that impacted your life and career decisions, all the way back to your family, if you would.
Well, starting with the family, my parents met at Emory, and they were a man, my father, who was originally from Barbados, went to law school, decided not to practice law, but to become an insurance adjuster, later a claims manager. My mother was from Rest Haven, Georgia, was a nurse. They had 7 children together. Then, sadly, my mother died when my youngest sister was 2. I was the oldest child, and I had always grown up hearing that I'm a poor man, honey. That's what my father would say. You all are going to have to get scholarships if you're going to go to college. So I went to college working and on scholarship and then on to law school in a similar fashion. Not really because at the time I really was certain I wanted to be a lawyer, but just that was a path that seemed open to me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have the passion for law when I first went to law school that I developed later in my career.
What was your passion in college? What courses of study did you follow in college that you were interested in?
Well, I attended Georgia State undergraduate, and my inspiration to major in sociology was a good friend of mine, Dr. Jacqueline Bowles, who was a full tenured professor, a woman professor at Georgia State. And her area of interest was sociology of work, and work including alternate and even deviant careers, everything from gypsies to sex workers to strippers. She had studied entertainers. In fact, her last book was on entertainers. And she was very inspiring because she had achieved much, written much. She was well respected in her profession. She had a husband and 2 children, and she's just a very nice and very interesting person.
She sounds delightful, and it's so creative that she would take the sociology of work and then even get into deviant careers, which I think is fascinating and brilliant. What led her on that path, do you think?
Well, I think it was her husband. Her husband was a very interesting man who had planned to go to dental school at Emory and then for some reason had taken a different path and done things entrepreneurial and including having his own piano tuning business and mail order things. But he was a very bright, interesting, eccentric man who had at one time worked with a carnival. And I think that's what inspired her. She's a very sweet woman, and I still see her today, although she's in her 80s and not very mobile. We go out to lunch every month or so, and she is just such a fascinating person and well-known in Atlanta just for her open-mindedness.
So I can see that she was a strong influence.
Yes.
And what triggered you into law school? I mean, how did you...
Well, as much as I enjoyed sociology, I could not see myself taking Jackie's specific path. Mm-hmm. Although I am fascinated by alternate and deviant careers and I enjoyed all her coursework, I couldn't see myself writing a PhD dissertation on anything that really aroused my curiosity and passion for sociology. And so many people, and this is kind of odd because I have nothing against social workers or social work. They're great people. God bless them. But, oh, you're in sociology. You're interested in social work then. You'll have to be a social worker. And it's a very competitive thing. And I couldn't see myself going on for the typical 5 years after college and writing a dissertation and then moving around the country and teaching undergraduate students sociology first as an I just didn't see that as a career path.
Right.
And my father and my uncle by marriage were both lawyers. And my fiance at the time was in law school. And I tend to score well in that sort of test. So it was okay. Just sort of something that I fell into. I could go to law school. I would be good at that. I scored high on the tests. I could get at least a partial scholarship to go to University of Georgia and be with some of my friends and fiance at the time. So I went to law school.
Okay. Did you like it from the get-go or did you not?
Well, I have to say that Athens is a very nice town. The University of Georgia Law School is a wonderful law school. But after sociology, I did find the law a bit dry. What I enjoyed in law school more than studying for a test or writing a practice brief was actually working for lawyers. By my second year, I had found that there were, at that time, a lot of lawyers outside the metro areas who wanted students to do research. And I found that I was fascinated by solving actual problems that had actual solutions. And I got job offers from, I think, virtually every lawyer that I did paid legal research for. That was my supplemental income in school. And one of the lawyers that I worked for, who was a tax lawyer and also a CPA in Savannah, Georgia, and I'd always wanted to really go away, you know, from Atlanta, and Athens is awfully close. And so it was exciting to have a job offer from a lawyer that I'd done some research for in Savannah, who was well respected. So I went down to Savannah. I took that opportunity and made that big step to go 250 miles away from Atlanta and pursue a career in law, of all things, a tax lawyer, which was my worst subject. I mean, to this day, what I learned in federal income taxation was to hire a good CPA to handle that.
So did you jump right in this firm, and which aspect of law did you...
it was litigation. The lawyer that I worked for was mainly a CPA and a tax lawyer, and he was involved in some fascinating litigation that it would take too long to go into in a short interview, but it was fascinating and involved a multi-million dollar estate and litigation between corporations and potential conflicts of interest. And finally, the case went up on appeal to the Supreme Court, and I changed jobs at that point because since that case was on appeal, there was nothing for me to work on that specific thing. So I changed jobs to a lawyer who had a more general practice in real estate. Then that lawyer moved to Augusta, and I decided I was ready to come back home to Atlanta, where I got a job in Atlanta, first on a contract basis, then gradually, you know, as a full-time associate of a law firm. And then finally, I was a partner, a named partner in the law firm. Then after 7.5 years, I decided to set out on my own and have my own practice.
How old were you in the storyline here?
Well, I was about the typical age, a year or two older, because there were some gaps where I worked between high school and college, and which I highly recommend, by the way, because I think that education is not just going to school, it's training and experience. And you can get lots of training and experience in a waitress job, a restaurant job. Anything that you do that is paid work is very valuable to you in learning. And not just for the purpose of going to a restaurant, if you're working in a restaurant, say, but learning about people. And I think that mere academic education is not always the best way to learn. I think I've learned a lot from traveling and from my other jobs besides my legal related jobs.
I couldn't agree more. This is very fascinating. Thank you. Let's go back to the theme of the show. We've been talking about it from your perspective, but what do you think about the international statistics in the last 20 years about the majority of people in the 70s in this country and in the 80s, high 80s around the world, when asked the question, are you able to use your, do what you do best at work? The majority of people say no. And so there are a lot of economic, social, political reasons for that. But as far as the individual goes and his or her decisions about their life and careers, why do you think people get stuck or settle for less than the best for themselves?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. Not realizing that there are possibilities is one thing. And I think that, sadly, some people are saddled with family responsibilities that, you know, make them feel that they can't do things because of their spouse or their children. And I say, well, that may be true to a certain extent, but I had a friend in law school who came to law school with 5 children. Her husband had taken a job in another city because she'd originally been accepted to a law school that she didn't consider in the league with University of Georgia. And when she'd been waitlisted and then subsequently accepted, her husband had already accepted a job in the other city. She packed up the 5 children and moved to Athens. Wow. And she was able to graduate from law school with those 5 children, including she started school with a 1 or 2 year old little boy. And the girls were older, I think up to 12 or 13. But people would say, how can you do this to your children, go to law school full time? And she would always say, I'm doing this for my children.
Yes.
And I found her an inspiration that there's really nothing that can stop you if you really have a goal and you really want to go forward. And
yes,
I was always very inspired by her.
So people don't realize there are more possibilities than they are. They have family or financial responsibilities. Real world experience is key. What other influences are there that you could comment on that might be useful to people at whatever age in their career?
I think when you first start in a profession, once you're in a profession, get involved in that profession. I know a lot of the young people now are really into organized networking, where you're supposed to touch base with everyone and mentoring, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And that is important. You do need to have friends and mentors and associations with various associations, but not for the sake of resume building. What I see that I don't like to see is a lot of resume building. I say one of the things that I did, and I can mention just 2 organizations, and it doesn't matter what 2 organizations, you pick 2 good organizations. My 2 were the Lawyers Club of Atlanta, which is mostly a social club, but an organization of lawyers who are together to be social, collegial, and not to one-up each other, that it's more purely social, although with an educational and networking aspect. Mm-hmm. And the other was, in my case, the Georgia Trial Lawyers, because I handled mostly plaintiff cases representing consumers in disputed issues, from personal injuries to perhaps contract cases involving bad faith against insurance companies. But find someone in these organizations that you enjoy and that you have people that you can talk to. I think it's important to be involved in organizations that further the kind of things that you're interested in. And I'm trying to make this more general, so perhaps
sure.
Could say this in a more succinct way, but try to be the best that you can be in your profession by learning as much as you can from other people, not just from formal seminars, not just from books or reading newspapers, whatever your profession is, learn from other people. I find now as a judge, formerly as a lawyer, I learn a lot from going to seminars, not from the seminars and the educational aspect where you have a speaker, a talking head talking, but by talking to another judge, another participant, in the past, another lawyer. Well, how do you do this? Have you encountered this situation? And it's amazing, not just on a purely professional level, but on a business level as practice management. There's so much that can be learned from talking to people who do the same thing that you do or something similar. And people often, we just turn to Google now, or we turn to a book, or we ask some of the usual suspects. But it's good to get out, particularly when you're traveling, to go to a seminar outside of your region, outside of your state, and to find out how other people think and how they do it. I find that fascinating and very useful.
Yes, I agree. I like both things you said about that, the pragmatic experience of getting out in society, no matter what you're doing, waitress, waiter, mechanic, it doesn't matter, just get out there and mix it up. And then I like this about learning from people that are on a similar path. So I don't want to miss the part of the storyline where you made the big decision and then had this...
Oh, to run for judge.
Well, yeah. This is pretty staggering. So how did that work?
Well, that is a strange story in some ways. I actually involved in one of my organizations. There was a perception that the Court of Appeals had some biases and that there ought to be someone who would run for judge who would not be biased, say, against consumer issues. And because there was such a feeling that there was that sort of thing, that there was a search for who will run for this, who will run for the court. And many lawyers are very shy about putting their name forward to run for things. Many people, particularly women, all the statistics show that if women run, women tend to win. They tend to do well. If you have a race with all men, a lot of people will vote for the woman just to vote for the woman, statistically. Mm-hmm. But women tend to have this thing where they feel that they're not qualified. So I, as part of one of my organizations, was making some calls saying, well, who would like to run for this? And it was very frustrating because some of the usual suspects, people that you would think, oh, she's qualified, why doesn't she run? Oh, no, you know, I couldn't do that. I couldn't leave my law firm, or, you know, I wouldn't take that step. I would try for an appointment, but I would not try for a statewide election. Well, why not? And it finally occurred to me that while I'm urging other people to run who were qualified, they say, no, I don't want to do that. And that they should do it. They should want justice. They should want fairness. They should want bias not to occur. They should be willing to kind of put their money where their mouth. Well, why wasn't I willing to do that? And I sort of floated my name, and it was sort of immediately, oh, yeah, well, maybe not you. And I was insulted, and it was like, if not, why not? Mm-hmm. And the answer came back partially, well, because you're a woman, and there's never been a woman elected statewide in the state of Georgia without benefit of incumbency. And I go, no, that's just wrong. Why haven't they been? Women have been elected and reelected, for instance, two of our Supreme Court justices, Carol Hunstein and former Justice Leah Sears, had been elected over opposition. So that couldn't be true. But looking back at it now and knowing what I know now, there are studies that show that people don't tend to support women and tell women that they should run. And so since I wasn't encouraged to run by the powers that be, I went out to dinner with some friends, including a couple, a married couple, and the man was older than my friend, the woman who was my age. And he said, why don't you go ahead and run anyway? And that had never occurred to me.
Wow.
And so I did it. I went ahead without having the support or backing of any of my social groups. I just went down and qualified and ran. And in that race, I almost won a statewide race, although I just walked up to qualification without any real training, education, or experience about running for office. It was sort of ready, fire, aim, and I got 48.2% of the statewide vote, which is unfortunately not enough to win a race. You must get 50% plus one.
I know, but let's get real here. That was a stunning. You were a newbie to the whole thing, and you all.
Yeah,
that's amazing. It's amazing.
It was considered amazing at the time by some of the people who would have supported me if they thought that I would do that well. And so when there was an open seat, another open seat available for the Court of Appeals, 2 years later, I ran and I was elected. But I always speak to women's groups and, you know, groups of people generally, that one thing to always think, if you don't run, you definitely will not win.
Right.
And it's rare that, you know, that people are just carried out on the shoulders to qualification, run, run, run. Generally, someone starts it themselves, and people should not be shy about that. One thing that I am very adamant about is that not just voting is a civil right, not just not being discriminated against is a civil right. Part of your civil rights is the ability to run for office. That's part of your civil right. You could run for office provided you're not convicted of a felony and not acquitted, and you haven't discharged your, well, it's different in different states, but that's a civil right. It's a civil right for you to run for office. And I think everyone would benefit from running for office once. You learn so much about politics, about human nature. And the funny and interesting thing is you learn about your friends and how they react to this.
Yes.
You learn about friends who you always thought were your good friends and would always support you who don't. And then you learn about friends who you didn't think, you thought were just acquaintances, who are ready to defend you to the death.
Good heavens.
It's fascinating.
Good heavens.
There's a whole psychology of who will help you and who will not. And
the
process is really an experience, particularly in a statewide race, a state the size of Georgia, the largest state east of the Mississippi.
It's amazing. It's a whole other interview we'll have to get into, because that's an amazing process. You've got to write this down one day. You know that, right?
Someday I will.
Yeah, you need to. It's just magnificent. Okay, so coming to the end of this illuminating interview, do you have a book or two that you would recommend to people as they're plotting their careers that have some meaning to you or that you respect and like?
Well, I have read a number of books by a number of people. It's so hard to pick out just one that's absolutely wonderful and inspiring. And in fact, one of the ones I would pick out is, I believe, out of print. Maybe you can get it on Amazon. I can remember the doctor's name who wrote it. The title is called Go For It by Dr. Irene Casorla. She played a cameo in the movie An Unmarried Woman. And I have given that book to two or three young women because it talks about thinking about out of the box and so on. But I believe it is out of print. I'm trying to think of something else. I read a lot of that sort of thing and just kind of store it and don't remember.
No, that's okay. We'll find that. We'll look it up ourselves. So what's happening for you in the next few years? How much longer are you going to be a judge? I probably shouldn't ask you that, but what do you look like in the next handful of years? What's your vision going forward?
Well, going forward, I love the Court of Appeals. There's always a possibility of another opportunity that would take me away from the Court of Appeals. But the Georgia Court of Appeals, unlike the trial courts in Georgia, you're not required to retire from the Supreme Court or the Georgia Court of Appeals, an appellate court, until you're 75 years old. That's something that I would consider. Many of the fine judges of the Court of Appeals served right up until their 75th birthdays and then came back and sat senior after that. But you're required under Georgia law to retire at 75. And it's the wonderful thing about the intellectually stimulating job that I have is that most of it is reading. And with modern communications, just as we're talking across state lines, I could talk or read internationally or across the country or from home to work. It's possible for me to do most of my work, which is research and reading, anywhere. So it gives me an immense flexibility. Yes. And that's the wonderful thing, an immense variety and an immense flexibility.
Yes, it's just absolutely wonderful. So what are you proudest of?
Proudest of? That's a difficult question. I have a wonderful family. I don't have any children of my own, but I have nieces. I have a wonderful husband. Siblings that are great. The Court of Appeals is a great place. I have dear, dear, wonderful friends. As far as my own personal achievements, I wish I'd had that question in advance because it's really just hard to say. It's something that I would have to think about.
Well, we'll have you on the show again.
I'd love to do it.
All right. Well, this has been a great pleasure. Judge Ann Elizabeth Barnes, truly a great pleasure being with you today. We appreciate you sharing the highlights of your fascinating story and your journey. And I know that listeners have learned lessons that will help them on theirs. Do you care if listeners get connected to you in any way, or do you have a website or social media that they could find out more about you?
Yes, I do. I will append those to the information. It'll be available on the information appended to the podcast.
Excellent. Yes.
I have a website, a Twitter account, a Facebook page, etc.
Perfect. Yes. As listeners know, you can go to discovertalentpodcast.com and go to the show notes page and look up Judge Ann Elizabeth Barnes, and there it will all be the highlights of the interview as well as the links to the various media. Thank you, listeners, again for joining us today. As always, you know we have an infographic based on an ebook, What Do Highly Successful People Actually Do to Succeed? 12 Proven Career Building Strategies to Help You Do What You Love, which we've talked about for a long time now. It's a nice piece, a compilation of the great thinkers in the field and used by millions of people that we hope will be a kickstart for you wherever you are in your life's journey. You can also subscribe for free on iTunes and Stitcher. If you do, we would like that. If you like the show, we would love for you to tell us how we can serve you best and how we can provide content that's special to you. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We don't learn them. We cannot ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive, we thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best in whatever you do. Have fun out there today.